dropping at one point over 700 points today as investors digest trade fight fears.
This is just a proposed idea, which will be vetted by USTR and then open for public comment. So nothing's happened. Nothing's been executed.
The battering ram knocking stocks around all week is really the don't call it a trade war with China.
For the most part, I thought this was all about the potential, I say potential, trade war with China.
Why is President Trump starting a trade war? Why is he putting up tariffs? Which, by the way, we haven't so far. About this, why has China gone two decades without making the changes that the entire world and the governing organization knows they've been breaking? Why do they continue that? Blame China.
You know, because of this trade garbage, the market's off.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Are we entering into a major trade war between two of the world's largest economies, or is this simply negotiating tactics? Trade was the big story this week on Wall Street, and the markets are having none of it. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Luis Yamada will be joining me in the first hour, and she's saying it's not over until it's over. It's not clear if we are heading into a bear market territory, or this is just a brief pause before stocks head higher, but overall, Louise is cautious, and you're going to want to hear why. Also, Robert Rapier will be joining me as we look at the energy markets, a focus of much of today's program. We may be sleepwalking our way into another oil crisis. You're going to want to hear what he has to say. Ryan Poplava will also be here as we talk about what moved the markets this week. All of that coming up in Hour 1.
And I'm John Loeffler. If you've been to the gas pump lately, you will notice that the prices seem to be up, due in part to, higher oil prices in terms of price per barrel globally. In some states, it's due to rising gasoline taxes. But the good news is that the gas prices are lower than they were a decade ago when, if you remember, oil was at $150 a barrel. And we were talking of peak oil then because it looked like we were going to plow into some kind of an oil crisis by about the middle of this current decade. But that all changed with shale oil production, except for the fact that everyone now believes the world is awash with oil and the sky's the limits, and it may be there's another perfect oil storm forming on the horizon, which no one is watching. So we're going to look at that in the first part of the big picture today. Also, we've talked about retail apocalypses and the credit markets, and some people are saying the retail apocalypse hasn't really started yet because many of these businesses have managed to hold on by rolling debt forward. So what will that mean for retail sales and for investment? All of that coming up on the big picture today as a part of the Financial Sense News Hour. And this is our want at the beginning of every week. Welcome back, Ryan Poplava, to talk about the catalysts and drivers of the financial markets. It was a very random walk on Wall Street this week with stocks up and down anywhere from, 1 to 3% each day. It appears that the selling from the past few weeks has either been halted by long-term moving averages, but you know, we're not shying away from these levels either. So what was the cause of the gyrations, and what can you tell us about the near-term trend?
For the most part, this week was still about the back and forth between China and the U.S. on tariffs. Over the weekend, China made its decision to move forward on tariffs on over, there was like 128 products. And that has followed up by comments from Trump. He was threatened to leave NAFTA if Mexico didn't do more to secure its border. So trade, trade, trade. It's just all been about trade this week. And it didn't stop on Monday. But with everything that Trump said on Monday with NAFTA, with the China retaliation over the weekend, the market fell right through the 200-day moving average, the support level you mentioned, that everyone's been following very closely. And that's been the first time that this has happened for the S&P since June of 2016, so quite a long time ago. Tuesday night, the Trump administration released another $50 billion in tariff plans across, it was like 1,300 products, in which China immediately retaliated with the equivalent size on 106 products, including the key ones, the ones they'd left out the last time they slapped on, I think that was at $3 billion. So The key ones are soybeans, planes, cars, and chemicals, which, as I mentioned, they really didn't touch the last time, you know, a couple of weeks ago, they were announcing tariffs. So Wednesday, stocks got a lift when Director Larry Kudlow came out and told reporters that there was a chance these new tariffs don't actually go into effect, saying that Trump wants to solve these trade issues with really the least amount of pain as possible. And then, of course, Thursday night came and Trump did the exact opposite, escalated things even more, asking the Office of U.S. Trade Representative to consider whether it should be appropriate to impose another $100 billion on top of the $50 billion just proposed this week. So that, too, has led the Chinese to respond in kind, saying they're going to do whatever's appropriate to protect their interests. So, John, it's a tit for tat. You know, with essentially the ante being raised on a trade war, it has led investors to kind of second guess just how strong earnings will be able to grow this year as a result of all the direction it appears the trade war is taking. It's escalating. While hopefully as some of these proposals are in a comment period, I mentioned that last week, and as Larry Kudlow very carefully put it this week, there could be that chance that we could de-escalate, but it doesn't appear to be the case right now.
Yeah, and it does have the markets in the jitters. I mean, both sides have been throwing a few punches here and there. But so far, I'm going to say it sounds like we're only in round one or two of this trade war where there's sure plenty of energy to go around throwing punches back and forth. It's like wrestlers swimming off of each other before they really get down to the mat and get down to the nitty gritty part of it. And also to see what the end game in this whole thing happens to be. But, you know, further into the boxing match, the fighters start to get tired and then more careful and then question, well, is this really worth it? So we'll see. The Wall Street Journal made it sound like sides are negotiating last week, but that doesn't appear to be the case yet. And I'm saying yet because, as you pointed out, we're just in the starts of this whole thing. All right. Well, it's the odd thing because it's not necessarily the first week of the month, but this week was when the important jobs report and the ISM numbers were announced for last month. So how are things looking so far?
Basically, not too hot, not too cold either. Some of our measures like the ISM manufacturing and service numbers, they were announced this week. They both dropped a little bit. So we're still expanding, but a slight deceleration, very slight. I didn't really read too much into it, but 59.3 for manufacturing and 58.8 on services. The one thing I did take a note on is if you look at the manufacturing reading, one of the components was the price component that showed a much elevated reading, right around 78.1. And that's the highest reading we've seen since about April 2011. So input prices, definitely something we're right now very much trying to focus in on any kind of telltale signals that inflation is starting to tick up. We've been talking about this since January. The private ADP payrolls, so that's no government jobs, it's strictly just private payrolls, was up pretty big. It was up about 241,000. And that's typically, it leads on what we see on Friday with the Bureau of Labor Statistics non-farm payrolls. And it typically, they correlate with each other, but we didn't see that. Jobs were only up 103,000 in March when you take a look at both government and private. And that was well below consensus. I think consensus was right around 175,000. So we didn't hit that. So a sizable tick back. And also, if you look at average hourly earnings, they ticked up. If you recall, they did tick down in February. But here we are looking at March with a tick around 0.3%. Year over year, that's something like, I think, 1.7%. So up from February, but not as high as we saw in January, was around like 1.8%. Factory orders were also up about 1.2% in February. So all in all, looking at the economic numbers this week, not enough to really get us out of this consolidation to really say there's new momentum, that things are looking hot. Of course, we don't want too hot either. If there's too hot on the inflationary side, then we get more concerned that the Fed's going to have to be more aggressive.
Well, I know on Friday, suddenly I heard this announcement, waiting for Fed Chair's comments. Fed Chair Jerome Powell apparently addressing investors. That caught me by surprise. How did his speech impact the market?
There was very little difference between his message and the March Fed statement. I read both pieces. The issue that seemed to exacerbate kind of selling on Friday, which happened as Powell was talking, because Powell made it pretty clear that a trade war is not on the docket. It's not on their menu. It's not on their discussion right now. So he didn't really talk too much about that. Rather, he stated he thinks that inflation will pick up this spring and he sees further rate hikes, of course, down the line. We're going to continue the pace. 3 hikes this year expected. So that's not what investors wanted to hear, John.
Yeah. And the Fed, you know, gave no indication that any recent volatility is compelling enough to pause. It could mean, I mean, this is real speculation. Okay. It could mean that maybe they're going to take a 4th hike off the table if they think that it's getting too unstable. Cause, you know, we used to hear the term during Janet Yellen's tenure, everybody's data dependent. And obviously that seems to be the way they work. They do something until something gets jittery or breaks, you know.
Yeah, he stated the same thing at the end of his speech, that they're data dependent, like you mentioned. The 4th hike was really never on the table for them. It was the market who was looking at these inflationary numbers earlier this year and tying on a little bit more of a higher probability towards it. And so far, if you look at the federal funds futures, that dropped from last week. Last week, it was around 28% chance that we see a 4th hike in December. It's dropped down to 21%. So moving in that direction.
Okay. So it seems like economic announcements this week weren't too hot or cold as well. Well, maybe just right for ongoing Fed plans. I don't know. Anything else you wanted to focus on that happened this week that you think is of import?
Yeah, technically. We always have the technician in that first hour. Very important right now. It's a big factor in the day-to-day, how the market's reacting to these support levels, resistance levels with the 50-day moving average above currently. But stock indices continue to find support near this 200-day average. We dip below it and reversed higher in the S&P, which is something I wanted to see. I've been talking about that for about 3 weeks. And it looked like progress was made Thursday to kind of break the short-term trend down that we started mid-March. However, that big tariff announcement Thursday night sent us right back down, along with no real comforting assurance from the Fed. So my feeling, John, when it comes to support levels, the best scenario you want to see is a touch-and-go reaction. We got that in February because, of course, that was the first attempt at the level. So not the case this time around. We've been hovering around this 200-day average. It gets me a little bit more worried. So definitely, I've mentioned this about a month ago, 2 months ago, and back in February when we were rallying. Keep stops tight and be in a defensive posture if the support levels break. The consolidation, in my opinion, is continuing, and hopefully we don't break down into just an outright bear market mode where you've got a lower high and lower low. So far, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is the only one on a closing basis I've seen that has put that into place. And really, I want to see that across the board before I make any kind of a bearish call in that sense. But again, like I said, we're not doing the touch and go reaction like I was hoping to see. I was hoping to see us whip down below these levels and get right back above them. Not seeing that happen. So I'm a little bit more concerned. The upside right now is that estimated earnings growth this next quarter is, John, it's off the charts. That means expectations are high. That's the downside of it. If we continue to see these companies achieve, beat expectations, which normally they do because they sandbag, give you a low ruler so they can, of course, overcome it. So we're going to be watching how they guide. Are they going to continue to guide higher throughout the rest of this year for, let's say, next quarter? Then, you know, that's going to be some powder towards maybe a stronger rebound in the market. The thing to look for during this earnings season, in my opinion, is 2 things. And it's right around the corner starting next week. Communication from companies that input costs are going up. Heard that from General Mills recently. And the other thing is concerns over tariffs. So if companies themselves are saying, hey, we're concerned about tariffs, the playing field is very uncertain, I'm going to be concerned about that. So those are the 2 messages I'm going to be looking at when I'm looking at company earnings. And as I said, both of those could be potentially harmful. Expectations, like I said, they're high. You know, we saw that estimations have gone up since the first quarter for upwards of, I think, almost 20% earnings growth by year end. All due to, of course, the tax savings from the tax bill that was passed last year. If tariffs now get factored into a number of these industries as a hindrance for them in their sales, you know, that could counter everything that we saw Trump give us. My brother recently wrote an article, Trump giveth and taketh away. It's that kind of what we're dealing with right now. And Trump even recognized that this week. He said something that, you know, the Wall Street, we're dealing with short-term issues here, but he thinks that in the long term, it's going to help our interests. So we'll see.
And as you said, earnings kicks off on Friday next week with J.P. Morgan, Wells Fargo, and Citigroup, and it'll be on Friday the 13th. Ooh, spooky.
Ooh, spooky. Crazy.
We will be haunted by waiting for those, right? Yeah, okay. All right, anyway, Ryan Poplava, let's look forward to it. Going to see where the Fed's going to go, too. This is going to be interesting to see whether they maintain this stance and do four or three. They're going to do more. You know that. It's just a question of how much. So it's almost like a little race you've got going here. All right. See you next week, Ryan.
We'll see you, John.
Everyone loves the stock market when it's going up. Making money in the markets, when you think about it, seems easy, which it is when you're in the middle of a bull market. But stocks, as you well know, don't always go up. And there are times when they can go down, in fact, go down a lot, which is why you need to have an investment strategy to help you navigate the good times along with the bad. Not everyone has an investment strategy, and quite honestly, many of you don't. That is where Financial Sense Advisors can help. We can put together an investment strategy to help you navigate those volatile investment markets in good times and bull markets and the bear markets that follow.
Call Financial Sense Advisors now and let us help you to make the change from just retiring to thriving in retirement. Call now, toll free, 888-486-3939. Again, that's 888-486-3939. Investment advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. You know, Financial Sense NewsHour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense NewsHour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
If we continue to fall lower and start testing that February low and even starting to move below that, this is trouble. This is a bear market. This isn't just a correction. And I've been in the correction camp for quite some time. I'm not in the bear market camp just yet, but there are a lot of things that I'm seeing as far as my indicators and our timing signals that tell me this could very well be the beginning of a bear market. And what I'm noticing is that we've moved into these neutral signals across the board on all of the S&P spider sectors. And what we need to watch for is whether we're getting the money on these bounces. If we get a bounce here, is the money going into defensive sectors or into those aggressive sectors? And right now, if you go on stock charts, at least this morning and yesterday, the highest performers of the spiders were in those defensive categories, like healthcare, consumer staples, utilities. You're going to see those generally do well when the market is in a bear market.
It seems to be the same every week. One day the market could be up, next day it could be down, and then one day it could be in both directions. Is this the beginning of a decline or just a pause before another upward move? Joining me on the show is Louise Yamada from LY Advisors. Louise, when you see a market like we are today, it started out great at the beginning of the year. Every single week it was a new record. But things have changed since January 26th. We keep approaching that 200-day moving average line. And if you look at these rallies, they're not as strong and they don't get as high as they did before. What is this telling you right now?
Well, that's a very astute observation. January may well have been the peak for the time being. And the February rally failed at a lower point. The March rally failed at a lower point. And now today we're seeing a rollover after a good day yesterday. And the indication where you have lower highs is basically that people are selling into that strength. So as you said, it's not buying the dip. It's selling the rallies. And if that continues, we may see a break of the lows around 23,500 or 439 on the Dow.
Now, technically, when you're looking at this market and you have, like in the S&P, you've had several attempts where it's broken that 200-day moving average. And somebody once told me that the more times that you keep trying to do that, eventually you break through that line. If we were to break the 200-day moving average, how serious would that be for the market and what would it signal?
Well, given the configuration that's been traced out here since the January peak, we have what we would call a descending triangle. In other words, the February low and the recent low on April 2nd present support, and it's right there at the 200-day moving average. So you have a straight line across the bottom and a descending line connecting the rally tops. And that forms what we call a descending triangle. So what technically one can do is measure the back of the triangle and project the same distance down from the support line or the horizontal line that we just talked about. And that could take you well below 21,000 if it were to follow through in that direction.
And would this be a correction, in your opinion, in a secular bull market, or would this be the topping process heading into a bear market? I guess that's a big question. What happens if we go that low?
Well, that's a very good question, and we base it on a variety of indicators. I think it's a little early to tell for sure, but what we do watch, I mean, at the moment, you've got negative momentum on the weekly basis, you have positive momentum, but slowing on the monthly basis, and the daily just turned positive. Whether or not you can hold that right here, I doubt. I think if we continue to go down, you're going to see another decline in the daily. But what's happening is that the monthly momentum signals have been very helpful in identifying structural declines. And if and when they were to turn negative, then we would have much more of an indication that we were entering something more serious than just a corrective trend.
I want to talk about a group of stocks that have led this market over the last couple of years. They've been the stellar performers, and that's the FANG stocks. In your recent monthly piece, you talked about some of these stocks showing some weakness and breaking down. If the leaders start to break down, is that also a confirming signal that this is something a little bit more serious than what we've seen in the past?
I think that's a very good way to describe it. And basically, technology has been really the only strongly outperforming sector. We haven't been able to see a transition into industrials or a transition into materials or financials to a certain degree, but they're pulling back with everything else here, which is very interesting. When you take a Facebook, for example, it's already down 24%. So that's a bear market territory. So they are starting to roll over. The types of tops that we've been seeing in some of the other underperforming sectors like consumer staples and some of the healthcare are much broader 1 to 2 year tops. And we're just beginning to see the initiation of distribution for the technology. So whether or not we get another run for the roses here and get a secondary distribution down the road is something that we would watch for. But obviously, it was the only outperforming area. And what one obviously recognizes about outperformance is there's always something that outperforms into the tippy top, so to speak. And we may well find that that will have been technology again the way it was in 2000, but we aren't sure.
You know, the thing that struck me when this first correction took place, you know, the first time on January 26th, you did not get what I call the safety trade. Bonds did not rally. In fact, they stayed stubbornly high. You did not see a movement into areas like healthcare, staples. But on recent pullbacks, you've seen a little strength in staples. Utilities are doing better, and bonds have rallied. It's almost like we've switched from the risk on to the risk off trade.
That's a very good observation, Jim. And yes, to a certain degree, that has been developing over the past couple of weeks. And it may well indicate that we're going to see a little bit further on the downside, and those stocks that are already down will start to stabilize, at least in the short term. I think that overall here, one has to be cautious on the equity market. One has to monitor one's own portfolio, and as support levels break and uptrends break, you de-risk a little. You take some off the table. And at the point at which your stock has entered a downtrend, lower high followed by a lower low, is the time to either be fully protected or out. But the bond market, as you know, we've been anticipating a new structural interest rate bear market. In other words, that we are seeing the transition from 36 years of a falling rate cycle to a new decade or two rising rate cycle. And I think that's why you haven't probably seen bonds rally quite as much. I think they could rally a little bit more here as and if the market goes lower. But it may be also indicating that the market is going lower. We'll see. But overall, I think that what you do is sell your longer-term holdings of bonds and move to the short-term on the next reversal.
You know, something that also hits me about the bond market, Louise, we know that the Fed is cutting back on its rollover of securities to the tune of almost $30 billion a month now beginning in April. That's a big buyer, or has been a big buyer, of treasuries. We know that Japan has been pulling out of the treasury market. We know that China. So we have three big buyers, the Fed, China, and Japan, pulling out of the market. At the same time, our deficits are going back up again. In fact, next year, the CBO believes that the deficit will be close to $1 trillion. How much pressure? That's got to put pressure on the bond market when you have big buyers pulling out and you have more supply coming into the market. Sooner or later, that's got to cause interest rates to rise, in my opinion.
Absolutely correct. You've got it right there. And interest rates rising, if the economy can maintain as well as they've been saying it is, interest rates can rise modestly and not affect the economic development and therefore possibly not the market. But we've had six interest rate rises, and it's almost unheard of that the equity market doesn't take some kind of a stumble when you have that many interest rate rises in a row.
Typically, when you get towards the end of a business cycle and you're moving more towards a recession, because right now the indicators still show that the economy is growing, but towards the end, as you approach the end of that cycle, typically managers or money managers, Louise, switch to more defensive sectors. You see them move into staples, utilities, healthcare. Do you see any of signs of that happening at this point?
Well, a lot of those stocks have had quite large tops. Some of them have broken their supports after secondary distributions over 2 to 3 years. So you could have a rally back into the resistance level, but it's not the same kind of a rally as one that's taking price to a new high. So you have different kinds of advances in a market rally. You have the advances that come from a very new low that's just sort of a dead cat bounce. You can have rallies after support level, major support level is broken, that carries price back up into the resistance of that support. Once support is broken, it becomes resistance and then rolls over again as more people sell into that strength. Or you can have a rally that takes something to a new high. We still have a few of those, but not as many as we've had before. So I think one should be a little bit more defensive here.
I want to talk about something that I'm seeing, and let's move on to commodities, specifically oil and gold. Oil is being fairly strong. I mean, it's staying in the $60 range. Maybe the new trading range this year is somewhere in the 60s, where last year it was in the 50s. But Louise, whether you're looking at gold or you're looking at oil, the gold stocks and the oil stocks were following the commodity until the January correction. Since that time, the stocks have sold off more sharply and have not recovered. There's a divergence between the stocks and the price of the commodity. From your years of experience, when you see something like that, what is that telling you?
I'm not sure that I can recall a time when we've actually seen that with oil, but the stocks do look weak. Many of them are so weak that they probably are going to at least stabilize near their lows, but some of the larger names may have further corrective action. The price of the commodity itself has been flat. We saw the potential for a slight pullback. It didn't happen, but what's happening is you're moving into a flat trading range. It's not moving aggressively higher, which is really interesting. And even though we have potential target towards 70, you haven't really seen WTI move up in that direction. And it's just more or less flat. And that's very interesting. Gold, on the other hand, has a different relationship. And of course, if you think about oil, you've got so much supply coming online everywhere, including here. We're almost energy independent. So it's difficult, although technically we have targets that are higher, it's difficult to rationalize how, given the world supply and the immense move to alternate energy, how we're going to see oil really soar anytime soon unless something untoward happens in the world. But gold is a different story. Gold has an inverse relationship to equities. When equities are outperforming, gold tends to underperform. And when equities move into a bear market, and underperform, then gold tends to outperform. So it's in an ascending triangle, just the opposite of what we're seeing in the equity market. And the possibility, of course, that gold can get through the resistance level that's been there for quite a time here at about 1366, and then 1400, even a more important resistance. As and if that happens, I think that it will happen only as and if the equity market moves into something more substantial on the downside.
So maybe the catalyst that the gold bugs have been waiting for is really a downturn in the stock market. What strikes me, something else that is unusual about the cycle that we're in, because we're seeing a lot of anomalies. And one that strikes me, Louise, you have to wonder what's going on in Washington. And that is we've had tremendous stimulus come into the market this year with tax cuts and then additional government spending. Typically, you do not see this in a late stage business cycle. You typically see Washington spend money, cut taxes when we're, let's say, in a recession to bring us out of one. But now we have all the stimulus coming into the market. The economy is growing, but working against it is a Federal Reserve that is not only raising interest rates, but is also shrinking its balance sheet. It seems the two are on a collision course. And if I had to make a bet who would win that battle, I would bet on the Fed.
Well, it's a very interesting conundrum because as our deficits, et cetera, go up and you have more supply in the bond market and interest rates are going to rise, it's going to cost us even more to pay the interest on the Treasury notes. So it makes the debt even worse.
And that, you know, from my perspective, that just means more supply, fewer buyers, that has got to mean higher interest rates. And I just wonder, with all the debt in the economy, whether you look at corporate debt, which has gone up as a result of stock buybacks, companies borrowing money, it was cheaper to borrow and buy back stock, or M&A activity. Consumers have got their balance sheets leveraged again. The good news is their 401ks are higher and their houses are worth more. But still, we have a lot more debt in the economy today than, let's say, back in 2008.
Yeah, I think it's a little frightening, frankly. I'm not sure how you solve it, except I would have preferred to see them simply bring back the corporate money and let them spend it here rather than increase the deficit and the debt with the other tax cuts, which I'm not sure are doing that much of a benefit for people.
Now, let's throw some of the other things that are out there now that the markets tend to worry about. One day it could be trade, and now we've got that. You know, they say it's basically negotiating tactics, but, you know, each side keeps upping the ante in terms of the amount of tariffs that they want to lever against the other side. That cannot be good news for the markets overall.
You know, the trade wars and tariffs have always been a negative for the economy and for the market. Simple as that.
They say every bull market, every bear market has its own characteristic. As you look back over the last 9 years and take a look at where we are in this market, does anything stand out to you in comparison to other markets that you've experienced in your career?
Well, I think we've never seen the kind of Fed stimulus that we've experienced in this particular market, especially from the 2009 point. I mean, the market would have gone much lower if the Fed hadn't come in, and we would have had a lot more disasters. But the other side of the coin is we might have gotten it over faster. I'm not going to go there, but we've been able to stabilize, and that's a good thing, and now we're trying to normalize. So, no, I haven't really seen the kind of Fed easing that occurred in this particular equity environment. But as you say, as the supply comes back in, I mean, I think the healthiest thing here is for the market to go sideways. Whether it can do that or not, I don't know. But January was an incredible advance. You could call it parabolic. And at the moment, I think we're at the very least unwinding some of that parabolic area. And sideways would be the best course. If we see supports break, then we have a different resolution.
And finally, Louise, given what you're seeing right now, we're not really quite sure if this is just going to be a consolidation and we head higher, or maybe we have hit the top in January and we are now in this topping process heading lower. What would you be doing as an investor?
I'd be very cautious. I would be very cautious. I would be patient. Let's see what happens. Monitor your individual portfolio holdings And as I said, if supports break and uptrends break, you've got to be lightening positions or protecting them, because I think that I don't see a new high in the immediate future. Let's put it that way.
Good advice. Well, listen, Louise, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, tell them about your monthly newsletter. You cover a lot of areas. You cover the major markets. You cover commodities, currencies, interest rates, and also a little bit of education in every newsletter.
Well, you're very kind. Yes, we publish monthly, the end of each month. And anyone who would like to get a sample and see the subscription information, just Google my name and send us an email. Thank you, Jim, always for that kind boost.
Should you buy and hold at a market top? At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we believe valuations, leading economic indicators, and other metrics are essential for prudent investing to both identify long-term opportunities and minimize risk. Every day, we keep a watchful eye on the markets, continually assessing the investment landscape so you can focus on the things you love most. Don't put your hard-earned wealth at risk.
Give us a call at Financial Sense Advisors. Call toll-free 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor.
In-depth interview from people who monitor all aspects of the markets and the economy during the Financial Sense NewsHour weekday show. Here's a brief clip from this week.
A lot of people have called some of these companies zombie companies, meaning that if it wasn't for the low rate environment, which made debt easier to roll over or service, they probably would have gone out of business several years ago. And as we see rates rise, the expectation is that a lot of this debt won't be able to be serviced, that investors will either decide to not make that investment, or they'll try to get their money back in some way, like pushing the company into liquidation to try to get better return on their debt. So, yes, I mean, in very sort of big terms, there was this era of cheap money that kept a lot of companies alive, a lot in the retail sector, and now we're seeing money become more expensive. And as that happens, we expect more retailers and other companies even in other sectors to go bankrupt and potentially liquidate.
Well, since the beginning of the year, oil has been ranging in the $60 range. Will it stay higher? Will it go lower? It's up nearly 30% if we look back at last fall. Is this the beginning of a new run in energy? Joining me on the program is Robert Rapier. Robert, I want to begin our discussion. You and I were just talking before we went on the air that we've got oil prices up close to 30%. If you look at the stocks, you take a ETF like XLE, XLP, some of these energy ETFs, they're down for the year when the price of the commodity they sell is up 30%. And on top of that, these energy companies are coming out with spectacular earnings. What accounts, in your estimation, for this estimate? Because going back to last August, when oil began to rise, oil and oil stocks, energy stocks were rising in tandem. There was a divergence that began in that correction that began in January. What accounts for this, in your opinion?
Yeah, Jim, I'm kind of baffled. Like, you know, as we discussed, over the past 12 months, oil prices are about 30% higher. And all of the major energy indices, the XLE, the XOP, which is a lot of the small cap drillers, they're actually both down. Earnings are coming in great, and yet we have these companies falling. Now, in the midstream sector, that's the worst hit. The MLPs have gotten battered in recent months, and there are some legitimate reasons for that, but they've sold off 20% over the last, well, since August. And oil prices were $45 a barrel in August. They're $60-plus dollars right now. We've got serious infrastructure constraints coming out of the Permian Basin, coming out of the SCOOP and the STACK. And so this bodes very well for the midstreams and the MLPs, and yet sentiment in the sector has turned sour. And I think that's what's happening with some of these oil companies. Sentiment is sour. People are still thinking, you know, oil is on its way out. So I think we've got this disconnect between oil companies and actual oil prices, where people are actually having to go out and buy the commodity. There's just a fundamental disconnect about the perceived long-term value of these oil companies.
Do you think there, I mean, there's a lot of myths out there that shale is going to drive the price down, that electric cars are going to get rid of the demand for energy. And, you know, you take a look at the average car in the U.S., the age of the fleet is about 8 to 9 years. We just went through a renewal of the automobile market in this economic recovery. Everybody's been buying cars. And so, Robert, I just don't see the electric car market. In other words, if we were to look out 10 years from now, sure, there's going to be more electric cars on the road, but is it going to be 50, 60, 70% of the auto fleet? I don't think so. And you're certainly not going to put a 747 or Dreamliner in the air on solar batteries.
Right. And even if, let's say even if we get massive penetration of electric vehicles, somebody messaged me today, they just bought a Tesla. And they said they know that I've written about Norway and how Norway had had triple-digit electric vehicle growth for 7 years. And they said something to the, I think they said Norway has now has 10% electric vehicle penetration. And I'd written before that as this was happening, gasoline consumption has gone up in Norway. And they asked me if I'd take a look at that again. They said, are you seeing now a drop in gasoline consumption? So I pulled the figures up this morning. February 2018 versus February 2017, gasoline consumption in Norway is higher. So it continues to grow. You know, I need to flesh these numbers out a little bit more and see if on a 12-month period it's higher. But, you know, just a snapshot month of February this year to last year, in the country that has the highest penetration of electric vehicles in the world, gasoline consumption is still rising.
I want to throw out a couple other things that I think the market isn't focusing on. Number one, the IEA and the EIA has continually upgraded their demand forecast each year. In other words, the demand globally with economic recovery and synchronized growth has been much higher than they estimated. So they've done that in the last couple of years. That's one factor. If you take a look at the investment banks for the last 6 months, they keep raising their price estimates for the price of oil. That's been going up. And number three, something that nobody is talking about, 81% of the fields that produce oil in the world are in decline. And nobody is talking about something, and this is the elephant in the room, and that is depletion. At the current rate of 5 to 6%, Robert, we're going to have to find four Saudi Arabias in the next 10 years.
Yeah, it's interesting you mention that because the CEO of the company I work for asked me to put together a report, and he wanted to know how much are we going to lose from depletion. And HSBC did a report called Peak Oil Report 2017, came out, I think, near the end of 2016, and they did that calculation. They said about 60 million barrels a day globally is in decline. And they did the sensitivity analysis of 5 to 7% decline out to 2040. And they said by 2040, just from existing fields, we're going to lose 41 to 48 million barrels per day. So just to stay flat, that, you know, that 60 million barrels, we're going to have to make up that much. That doesn't even include demand growth at all. So, yes, there's going to have to be a lot of oil. You know, when we talk about demand growing by 1 million barrels a day, that's what people don't get. We don't have to replace 1 million barrels. We've got to replace 1 million barrels plus whatever the depletion was for that year.
Yeah, because we're looking at 1 million barrels roughly for demand growth. And then you talk about depletion that's running anywhere from 3 to 4 million barrels. So we almost have to replace 5 million barrels. And for the life of me, I just don't think American shale is going to increase by another 5 million barrels. I may be wrong, but I just don't see it.
Yeah, it's going to be a challenge. That's one of the big questions, is just how much will shale increase? There have been various estimates from the EIA and the IEA, and I think the consensus is that over the next few years, we can grow by 3-4 million more barrels a day. That's been consistent among several estimates. However, that's not enough to supply the world, and it's not enough to cover depletion in existing fields. So, you know, one of the articles I recently wrote for Forbes was, are we sleepwalking into the next oil crisis? Because we're not investing enough to cover all the depletion and the increased demand. And many agencies have highlighted this issue, that because of the oil price plunge in 2014-2015, companies slashed capital budgets, and we, especially outside the U.S., there's just not enough being invested, and they're worried that there's going to be a supply crunch hit around 2020.
You know, that's interesting because I read that HSBC report or something else that they brought out that also factors into this. If you take a look at the oil basins, within an oil basin, you may have a large field within that basin that goes into decline, but the basin itself still maintains production because there's continuous drilling in that basin. But here's the fact that they brought out. The new discoveries tend to be smaller. And the other thing they brought out, smaller discoveries go into decline much faster than, let's say, the large oil fields that have been around for, you know, decades. You know, you think of Garwar, you think of Cantarell, how long those fields remained in production before they went into rapid decline. So that's another factor. The discoveries are much, much smaller. They're just not finding elephants anymore.
The biggest elephant in the past few years has been one that we've known about for 100 years, and that's the Permian. I mean, the Permian has been the hottest oil field in the world, but as you say, there are areas where depletion is occurring, and but new wells are being drilled. So how long can that keep up? You know, the Permian's interesting because there's some potential for oil production to increase another, you know, million, 2 million barrels a day, but they have severe infrastructure constraints. They can't deal with all the natural gas they're producing. They can't even get all the oil out. And so prices in the Permian are starting to be disconnected from the rest of the oil market. You know, they're depressed there because they simply can't get the oil out, or they're producing so much natural gas that they're starting to curtail production, some operators.
Yeah, you bring up an interesting point about infrastructure. It's not just the lack of investment that happened with the decline in oil from over $100 a barrel. Many companies, and this was also gets to your thesis about sleepwalking into an oil shock, and that is a lot of the major companies, from Exxon all the way down, pulled back on heavy investments. And as you and I know, Robert, if you are going to drill and try to replace your reserves, find new oil fields, it takes, 8 to 10 years to bring those fields into production. So even if they were to step up, investment, as they did that now, it could be years away before they would see the fruits of that come to hit the market. So you've got depletion that is increasing. You've got global demand that is increasing. You've got investment that has gone down. It almost seems like down the road, we're heading for a perfect storm.
Yeah, and a lot of that, as you say, because it takes years to bring this stuff online, at some point, this becomes baked in. And you say, you know, it's inevitable that we're going to have a shortfall. You know, this is what happened in 2003 through about 2007, 2008. There was a shortfall in investment. All of the global excess capacity pretty much dried up. By about 2007, it was mostly gone. So you had oil price shocks. You had, if Nigeria went offline, oil prices would spike a lot more than they do now. And that culminated in oil prices shooting up to nearly $150 a barrel and then staying, you know, they crashed back down, but they bounced right back up. And so we had several years of $100 plus oil as a result of years of underinvestment.
So as you look at this energy sector, right now we've got the price of oil, which is up 30%. It's holding firm within the $60 range. It seems to be trading between $60 and $66 a barrel. As you look at the energy sector, which has lagged, and as you mentioned, many of these energy indexes and the stocks themselves are down, even though their earnings are growing at 15-20% a year. What do you think is going to be a catalyst that could turn this around? Because people seem oblivious to what's going on with the energy stocks. Their earnings are growing. Their cash flow is growing. They're more shareholder friendly. They're increasing dividends, and yet they're being ignored by the market.
Yeah, I think it's like a herd mentality. At some point, you'll see money flow back into the sector. Once, you know, dividends are increasing, people are going to chase yield, and you'll see at some point people start to wake up and say, hey, this energy sector is really undervalued. They are making profits. Maybe the future isn't so bleak as I think it is. I really think, and I know I'm sounding like a broken record, I really think that the sector is severely undervalued, but fundamentals will win out in the end. And that's especially true for midstream. I mean, I think I said this the last time we talked, that midstream is seriously undervalued. And given the infrastructure constraints, it's even more so. I mean, we desperately need more midstream. We need more pipelines to get some of this oil out of these basins. And so, you know, everything looks good for midstream. There, you know, there's a few problems on the horizon for midstream. Rising interest rates make their yields a little less competitive. And so that's one issue. And then the tax reform actually leveled the playing field a bit. You know, MLPs don't pay corporate taxes. And so by reducing the corporate tax rate, it sort of evens things out a little bit. It lessens the advantage that they had. Nevertheless, a 20% sell-off, in my view, and in many views of some of the brokerages, I've read notes from them saying this is completely unwarranted.
Yeah, you know, I wonder how much of this is a holdover from, you know, you had a trend. Oil prices peaked in 2014, then they fell all the way from 100 plus all the way down to $26 a barrel in the first part of 2016. The oil stocks came down. There was a glut of oil. That's all we talked about. The glut, the inventories, the glut, the inventories. In fact, if you watched cable news every Thursday when they reported the inventory reports, it would move the market. And so you get this mentality that a trend in place. And the reason I bring this up, there was a trend in place called shorting volatility. The markets went up for almost a year and a half, not even as much as a 2% correction. So everybody loaded the boat on one side, shorted volatility, and we saw that explode and come apart at the end of January. It seems like you have the same thing going on in the energy sector. Everybody says, you know, you hear stories, electric cars are going to get rid of the demand for oil, shale oil is going to produce so much, there's going to be another glut. And you have all these myths that are out there. And as you mentioned, even if we could produce the oil, we couldn't get it to any place because we don't have the pipelines and the infrastructure. So how long before that mentality swings in the opposite direction? And does it take a catalyst? And here's the thing I'm thinking of. When we had crises over the last couple of years with an oil glut, I don't care if it was something in the Middle East, in Syria, the oil markets wouldn't move because everybody knew that there was plenty of oil around. Heck, they were storing it on ships. Now, we're down to almost about 1% in terms of excess capacity, which means if we were to have a crisis, say Venezuela went into civil war, the government fell apart, or Nigeria or something like that, or heck, Robert, we go back maybe a year ago or 2 years ago when we had the Canadian oil sands, that fire up there that took 1 million barrels off the market. I mean, something like that could actually ignite this market, and people don't realize how close or how narrow our safety margins are today.
Right. And I'll give you an example. It always takes longer to move the oil markets than I think it should. In 2013, you know, at the beginning of every year, I make predictions. In 2013, I said, you know, global inventories are starting to get pretty full. We've added a lot of shale oil. I believe prices have got to come down. And so I predicted in 2013, oil prices are going to have to fall. And I made the prediction that I think WTI would close the year lower than it opened the year. And in fact, I believe that year Brent closed a little bit lower, but WTI actually closed a little bit higher. And I said, this doesn't make sense in light of the fundamentals. We're really starting to swell inventories. And so in 2014, I made the prediction again. I said, price of oil has got to fall. We are really filling up our inventories here. And by June, oil prices were even higher than what I'd predicted. And I was scratching my head. I was thinking, you know, in light of the fundamentals, this makes absolutely no sense. And then finally, in July, the dam started to break. And then you know what happened? The oil prices came crashing from $100 and they went all the way down into the 20s eventually. And so we just overshot for so long. We didn't pay attention to the fundamentals. People kept hanging with the momentum of oil prices, but the fundamentals were saying this can't last. But I was a year and a half early saying, you know, oil prices have got to fall. They've got to fall. But it just took a lot longer. But when they snapped, they came crashing down. And you may see that again. You may see, you know, when some of these oil companies finally start to rebound, they may rebound very quickly.
Yeah, what is it about the energy sector? You compare it to the other sectors within the S&P. I don't care if you're looking at industrial stocks, consumer stocks, staple stocks. What is it about energy? We tend to go to extremes. You know, you think back to the summer of 2008 when we got to be $150 a barrel. And then you think of January 2016 when we got down to $26 a barrel.
What is it about the energy market? It's the world's largest, most important commodity in the globe, and yet we have the least amount of information in terms of transparency, and we always tend to go to extremes.
Yeah, I think the level to which we are dependent on oil makes people get very panicky when they think there's not enough. And so we drive oil prices very high. On the other end, the outlook, and many people have spun the outlook that, you know, oil is on the way out. Look at what happened to coal. Coal is being replaced by renewables, by natural gas, and a lot of people think the oil industry will go the way of the coal industry. And to those people, I always say there are many different ways to make electricity. There aren't that many ways to replace liquid fuels. Yes, electric vehicles eventually, but if you do the math, it's going to be a while. We're going to need millions of barrels a day more production than what we have now before electric vehicles legitimately make an impact. And you could say even then, it may be a lot further off than you think. Again, just look at Norway. If Norway's example holds true for the rest of the world, we may have tremendous penetration of electric vehicles and oil demand continue to go up, because population's growing and because developing countries are moving people into the middle class, you know, hundreds of millions, billions of people moving in the middle class and getting vehicles, some portion of which are electric vehicles, but some portion of which are combustion engines.
Yeah, and I think maybe the route that we're seeing a lot of automobile companies go is sort of hybrids, gas and electric, because as you mentioned with oil, we lack the infrastructure. We also lack the infrastructure in terms of electric vehicles. If I want to take a Tesla or someplace and drive across country, it's going to be a little bit more difficult than it would be if I had a gasoline engine where I can pull in everywhere and there's a gasoline station. How many charging stations are there around this country to support electrical vehicle fleet?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, there aren't enough, and I think people overestimate people's willingness to be inconvenienced. I think a lot of the electric vehicle, if you want to make a cross-country trip right now, you've really got to be a believer if you're going to do it on an electric vehicle. It's not nearly as convenient. You know, if you're making a regular commute where you can make that round trip and you can plug in at night, that's one thing. But if you're going to travel long distances, you really have to be a believer. You're going to have to plan your route, and you're going to have to stop for long periods of time to charge, and a lot of people just aren't going to be willing to do that. And that problem will get better over time, but again, it's going to take some time. You know, I remember Bloomberg predicting that by 2022, we were going to have the oil crisis of all time as EVs had hit a critical mass, and they were going to start taking enough oil share away that it was going to permanently crash the oil markets. And that's ridiculous. I mean, if you do the math, that's simply ridiculous. And 2 years after they've written that article, where they forecast EVs taking a bite out of oil demand is 2 million barrels a day higher than it was when they made that prediction. So it's going exactly in the wrong direction, according to their prediction.
So given the fact that we have a huge disparity right now between the price of the commodity, which is up 30%, where the stocks are down, earnings are up at double digits, cash flow is increasing, dividends are going up, they're buying back stock. If you had to put money to work in this sector, where would you go?
You know, I don't know how long it's going to take for sentiment to flip, but I think the most undervalued segment is midstream. And it's also, you know, typically more conservative and pays decent dividends. I mean, some of these midstreams yield 6 or 8%. So some of my money would go into midstream. I think some of the, you know, I own shares myself in ConocoPhillips and EOG Resources. Diamondback is one of my favorite plays out in the Permian Basin. They're growing production rapidly. There are so many undervalued sectors of the market. Now, refiners have done quite well. And I think they will continue to do well. It's just that they are not grossly undervalued in my view. So, I mean, you could put money into a Valero and you know, for 10 years, you're going to do okay. But I think you're just not going to see this sort of price appreciation that's going to occur when people suddenly wake up and say, wow, energy is really cheap. The energy stocks are really cheap. So, you know, if you're looking for, you know, if you've got a little bit more appetite for risk, some of the small cap drillers, oil field services companies, those, the sand producers, those guys will have a serious rebound at some point.
All right. Well, listen, Robert, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. If our listeners would like to follow your work, there are several places they can do so. Why don't you tell them about it?
Sure. I have a regular weekly column at Forbes. So I'm usually, in fact, it's been bumped up now to 7 times a month. So 7 times a month, I'll have a column at Forbes. This week, I published one on Master Limited Partnerships and how cheap they are. And then this morning, I published an article called The Permian Basin's Looming Bottleneck, which talks about the pipeline constraints in getting natural gas out of the Permian Basin. And then I have a regular weekly column at Investing Daily. Every Tuesday morning, they will publish a column that's more investment themed. And then I help manage a service there, a premium service called Real World Investing with Stephen Lieb.
Well, coming up next, a decade ago, we were talking about the upcoming oil crisis, but shale oil production seems to have ameliorated that for a while. And now the sentiment in the market is that everything is awash in oil as far as the eye can see into the future, as well as far as people can see geopolitically. But is that really true, or do we have another perfect oil storm forming on the horizon? And if so, what will it look like? What will cause it? And what does that mean for investments? All of that coming up next and more in the Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertised with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.